Du lyssnar på Tysklandspodden, en podcast från Goethe-Institut Schweden. I den här podcasten står Tyskland i fokus. Du hör samtal om litteratur, aktuella samhällsfrågor och kulturdebatter. Ibland är avsnitten på svenska, ibland på tyska och ibland både och.
In this episode, you hear the German clarinetist, composer and conductor Jörg Wiedmann in conversation with the Swedish guitarist and university lecturer Magnus Andersson. Jörg Wiedmann was invited to the International Composer Festival at Stockholm's Concert Hall, presenting one composer each year, not only with concerts, but also to deepen the understanding of the composer through activities such as a lecture at the Composition Forum, arranged by the Royal Academy of Music, and, for the first time ever, through a podcast produced at the Goethe-Institut in Stockholm. Listen to the German composer Jörg Wiedmann, interviewed by Magnus Andersson.
Everywhere I read when I prepared for this talk was that you were, first of all, from an early age, a clarinet player. And then you started composing through improvising. And then finally you went into composition. But now you have, it doesn't say much, but you're also a fantastic pedagogue, educator, considering from what I could hear that basically for a musician, I think, it's very much the same thing. You teach, you write, you play. Could you comment a bit on that? Do you, how you feel with the Bildung and the tradition you try to, because it was obvious that you live with these things almost every day.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's my pleasure to be here to talk to you and you introduce this week or these days, which where my music is so intensely played, and I really can't wait to work with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic. This is my first collaboration with them, and I conduct them the first time. So I really look forward to hear all these many pieces of mine here in Stockholm, and I hope that the audience can get an impression of the, if they like it or not, but of the variety.
Yes. Yes.
So even aesthetically, so if you hear three pieces of mine, you will be maybe surprised that they are written by the same composer.
I was going to ask you about this because they are very almost, if you superficial listener to it, this is an eclectic guy. He takes a bit from here and there, but where is he? But when you listen carefully, you can hear it's the same, the same man behind all this.
Exactly.
Yes.
I would also agree. I mean, music, it would be the harmonies.
Yes.
Harmonic progressions.
Yes.
Which may be as different as the pieces are. There is a certain harmony that you and, you know, but these questions sometimes, you know, also in other art forms, like in painting, in poetry, you know, it's, what I was always bored of was if somebody, an artist, also a musician, does something all over and all over again, all the time. And one day it's called style.
Yes. Right? Yes, yes, of course. Of course.
Really, forgive me, I'm a little bit still cold. So I was always bored by that. So what I tried is really to surprise myself by each new piece and try to do something different. I fail, of course, sometimes. I mean, you cannot reinvent the wheel.
No, no, of course not.
But we should try. So that would be one aspect you mentioned. The other aspect is the connection with the past, the connection with the tradition. And I believe very much in one thing with a sentence which mostly is described to be of Gustav Mahler.
Yes.
But it's not so sure if he said it, but whoever said it, it's something very beautiful. I try to say it in English. I only know it in German. So tradition is not the adoration of the ashes. It's giving the flame or the fire to the next generation, to give it to the next generation. So I believe very much in that. So my connection with the musical past is not a purely sentimental one. You know, especially it's not a nostalgic one. I'm not saying, oh, it was so beautiful in the 19th century. Let's write like that.
Yes.
Again. You know, half an hour ago, that was the opening of this festival with my music, and I heard the Schubert Octet, and I heard my octet in the same program played by the same musicians. That was so interesting. And there is nobody in the hall who would say, oh, it's not music of today. But at the same time, there are links. But to me, it's important. Is it still valid for us? Or is it still, can we make any use of it still today? And I believe very much in that, you know, in these instruments. You play the guitar, so these wooden instruments, can we still get something else out of these old instruments? Yes, I'm very convinced.
Absolutely. And actually, it's a connection with this, but I did, I was curating a festival in Stockholm, Stockholm New Music. They closed that down, unfortunately, but it was a big festival with all the big institutions involved. And the last one I called Tradition in Transition, which was very much related to tradition, how it can live on and how it always have to change, because it's important. You know, there's another sort of connection with this, that sometimes they ascribe to Schnabel, but also sometimes to Mahler too. But tradition, he said, is only also very often a string of bad habits.
Yes.
So we have to reinvent the tradition.
That's
what Mahler said. Yes. And but yes.
Your Schlamperei.
Yes.
You know, what you call your tradition.
Yes.
It's
just laziness. Yes. Yes.
I had the privilege to work with a lot, but this sentence, it's harsh.
Yes.
But there's some truth about it. And
maybe
that answers a third aspect, which you touched, talking about Adorno. Believe me, I have also problems with him, especially when it comes to his judgments.
Yes.
Music.
Yes.
You know, for example, since we're in Scandinavia here, his complete ignorance towards a fantastic and modern composer like Sibelius.
Yes, I know.
For example.
But yes.
Or of Janáček. He did
I know.
In general, Eastern European music, there was a certain arrogance, which I don't agree with at all. But we must face that he was in whole music history. I think that's beyond any doubt, he was the most knowledgeable philosopher, knowledgeable about music.
Yes.
If you read, for example, his analysis of the Alban Berg
pieces. Yes.
So in a few lines, you really learn about the piece.
Yes.
So that's really fantastic. And he criticized so many of my most beloved composers. But the funny thing is, he justifies it and with his beloved composers, which are also mine, which is Alban Berg and Mahler. You know, just imagine Berg and Mahler without pitch.
Yes.
Without tonality.
Yes.
You know, so he accused everybody else of that. But there he kind of apologizes or he excuses it. That's funny. So you mentioned how I called my lecture. It was called Schöne Stellen, which is even hard to translate.
Yes, it is.
it's beautiful moments or special moments in music.
Mm.
And it refers to a lecture, or actually an essay, which Adorno, actually it's a radio lecture, I think, which he gave with the same title, Schöne Stellen. And in this lecture, he accuses the bürgerliches Musikpublikum, the bourgeois audience, of only going to classical music concerts for the Schöne Stellen, for the beautiful moments.
Yes.
So he accuses them very harshly. And the really funny thing is, and not consistent thing, which I find very sympathetic, is that this essay ends with Adorno's own Lieblingsstellen, favorite moments. So there I wanted to think further.
Yes.
So I gave for the opening. It was the opening of the Boulez Salle. You know, it's this.
Ah, okay. Yeah, 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 yeah.
The audience sits in an oval space, like around a fire, around the space. And in the first night, I played my fantasy from above, from this oval thing.
The clarinet, that's a solo clarinet.
And I played with Daniel Barenboim and with Anna Poska. We played the Shepherd on the Rock, the Head of the Face by Schubert.
It was beautiful. Yes, yes.
And Barenboim trusted me so much, more than I trusted myself, I must say. He said on the second evening, so we played two opening concerts, two nights. And then on the actual third evening, he said, may I ask you to give a lecture on music history? So no pressure, right? So I was, so what you saw was exactly that.
So, amazing, because it seemed so well prepared, actually. And the amount of literature, you know, and you were a good pianist too, quite good. I'm sure you wouldn't consider yourself at the level of Barenboim, or others. But it was a workable thing for you. It was something
I grew up with it, and I accompanied my friends and my sister, who is a wonderful violinist.
When we were I know Caroline Wiedmann.
I accompanied her with the Brahms sonatas. I could not play all of them, and not every movement. Mostly the slow movements, but sometimes only the first movement of number one, only the last movement of the third Brahms sonata.
Still,
my fantasy pieces, I accompanied cellist friends. And as a composer, of course, it's my daily, you know, it's accompanying me every day.
Yes, but do you use an instrument when you compose?
But only in the Schumannesque sense.
Okay,
in order to get rid of it.
Oh, you know? I see. Yes.
So sometimes when I begin a piece, I sit for hours and days at the piano to get a sense of touch of the language of the harmonic progressions and so on. But I only do it for one purpose: to get rid of it afterwards.
Rid of it.
Because ears, I think, are more important than always trying at the piano.
So, yes. Because you're sort of, as a composer, quite inventive, but you can feel that you have it's not theoretical completely. It's not that you want to be outside, as many composers, sometimes with very good results, work. But you mentioned somewhere that the sound is very important. So I was thinking, what does it mean with sound? Because it can mean liberation of sound in the Cajun sense. But I thought, no, it's not this it means. But
it means sound itself.
Yes.
So what's the first idea of a piece? For me, most of the time, it's not the structure.
No.
I'm not somebody who has an idea of a symphony which is 1 hour long and I know exactly the form. No, I have a certain sound idea, like in my piece Insel der Sirenen, the Island of the Sirens. I had the idea of only very, very high pitches.
Only
the two highest octaves. So like a stratosphere. So I will go for that idea. But how does it work? So having an idea is nothing special, you know. So did I do anything for it? No. But I have to justify it by, in my case, doubt, you know, doubting the idea. So on day one, you are excited about this idea. You get more and more obsessed the next days after it. But then comes your doubt. And for example, in this piece I mentioned, my first and foremost question was, when does the first low note come?
Okay.
And that's how form is created in my music many times.
Yes.
So der Weg entsteht im Gehen. So through my walking, I find my way. Not always, you know, but most of the time. I'm curious and what you mentioned with the experimentation with sound, for me, it's nothing theoretical, and I'm not a mathematician. I do it as a child. It's a very childlike thing. You know, what does a child do when a child sits in front of the piano? First of all, it will not, most likely not play a C major chord.
No.
and be fascinated by it. It will play some cluster, right? Mm. Black and white keys. Mm. So dissonance. The great thing about children is they will repeat it. Mm. So they were fascinated by it. They repeat it. We, grown-ups, adults, it is after the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh time, we will stop and do something else. Mm. And the wonderful thing with children is the 101st time is not less interesting than the 100th time, on the contrary. Mm. So I work like that a little bit as well. So now that I heard my octet and the Schubert octet, I remember, you know, when we are backstage playing the Schubert octet and the horn player will do a joke or something or will experiment on this instrument, do something like that. Even if the stage manager says, please go on stage, I will say, please give us 10 seconds. I will ask the horn player, how do you do this? You know,
yes.
So this childlike curiosity remains very, very crucial for every art making.
Mm. So in a positive sense, composing can be a way of reinventing childhood, to always be in touch
never
with.
I thought about this definition, but yes. I already like it.
Yeah, you can use it.
Copyright.
Well, people ask me, you know, I thought of this because people ask me why I went into new music. And I said, it because I started with improvising and it was always this kind of discovery all the time. And now through new music, because I work with composers of all sorts, it's quite a way of keeping that fire alive, you know, that in yourself. But it's interesting to hear all this, actually. And I thought it was one speaking about how you compose and how different if we keep us at the orchestral thing. There is one piece performed here by the Norrköping Orchestra called Lied. And I was astonished when I heard this piece, because it says it's a kind of homage to Schubert, but it was no clear, I couldn't at least hear, perhaps they're hidden, no clear citations from it. Actually, the piece was like a walk that went through many years of music into the future. And then I thought of this, what is Bildungen, if I look at what it meant for Schlegel and the early romantic, is that the fragment, they thought of it, yes, it's a fragment that also has with the past to do, but the fragment is also a sign from the future.
Yes.
It means where we're going. So it's not only something isolated, it speaks about the future.
Yeah, that's very beautiful.
Oh, yes.
It goes both ways.
Yes, and I thought this is a very good example of what actually the romanticism, the ideal romanticism, that's actually looking for.
And that's a very beautifully, very beautiful observation. And I'm happy you didn't discover any citations.
At all. No, I looked for them.
Aren't any except one which nobody ever realizes, which is from a chamber music piece, which I just mentioned twice, the Schubert Octet, but it's only one little moment. And I don't care about it. It's not the most important thing that it's quoted.
Mm.
I tried to so Schubert, he, in his short life of 31 years.
This is unbelievable.
It's an unbelievable. Yes. He wrote more than 600 songs. And talking about childhood just now, I always asked myself, you know, in a psychological way, why does somebody constantly sing in his life?
Mm.
And I think it's for the same reason as a child who gets lost in the woods, right?
Mm.
Who gets lost after maybe crying or maybe before crying, I'm convinced the child will start to whisper either or to sing for one simple reason, to assure himself or herself that she or he is still there.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I have the impression with Schubert, that's the reason why he sings.
Mm.
So I tried to write something about this psychological dimension. And you described it in a beautiful poetic way. You said something, it's like a way.
Mm.
And you come by certain things and you find them from the past. But it's like fragments from the future.
Yes.
And I imagined very precisely that it's like in a dream.
Mm.
It sounds like kitsch when I say dream, but I mean it in a very literal sense. In a dream happened the strangest things, right?
Mm.
So you are in one world and imperceptibly you reach another, maybe even room, or you different colors or different persons. Mm. And what I'm interested in most in music, maybe next to sound, is transitions.
Yes.
So A and B, fine. But how do I get from A to B? That interests me most. And you will see and hear, I hope, in Lied, it's many, many transitions from one state to the other.
Yes, it's a kind of constant flux.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that was the
yes,
it's, what I tried it's, to do.
Yes. Well, you mentioned dreams here, but of course there is this famous letter to his father, I think, where he speaks about a dream he had, Schubert. It's for Freud, but more advanced in a way.
Exactly, and one of the most important works of art, of one of the great sculptures of all times of Giacometti.
Yes,
is this dream?
Yes,
this famous. Very erotic,
yes.
Sexually, driven, and that's where it comes from. But it was very, very important. But it came from a dream.
Yes,
I will never forget in the Berlin Festwochen, the festival in the Berlin Philharmonie. There was the guest orchestra was Cleveland Orchestra. Can you imagine? And they were on European tour, and they combined the Brahms symphonies with several of my works in different evenings. And in Vienna, they played especially Brahms and my music. But Berlin said, well, we hear the Brahms symphonies quite often here.
Yeah.
And they said to Cleveland Orchestra, please, we want a only Widmann.
And they did that.
They did that, and it was unforgettable. And the first piece they played, I mean, what an orchestra. I mean,
Cleveland is really fantastic. I know. Orchestra.
And I remember that really some of the finest musicians living in Berlin, German musicians, but international musicians, we were all in one row, as in one row. And I remember people like Tabea Zimmermann. Cleveland started, and the principal horn starts in triple piano, muted, and all violins start tremolo on the same note. They started, and in a way they didn't. There was sound, and in another way there wasn't. It was such a miracle. So I remember how all the musicians looked at each other, and they could not believe the sound Cleveland produced. I will never forget that because we talk about the piece Lied.
Yes.
It was unforgettable.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. But on the other hand, I was also very much intrigued by, I guess, an earlier piece called, it also sounds very much like, but it goes the other way. It's called Implosion.
Yeah.
That sounded not the same, but you heard it was the same composer. But here I almost thought of, is this Xenakis kind of thing? You know, where it is just distribution of sounds through statistics, or it's on mathematical, but it obviously is not. So on the other hand, I thought, where does that piece come from then? Is that from some kind of inner tension you have, or is it just an experiment?
I always have
inner tension, of course.
But, you know, it comes out in a different way. So if you hear a piece Lied, so for the people who don't know the piece, it's a very lyrical piece.
Yes.
Like 20 something minutes.
Mm.
Very slow piece. And Implosion is a very aggressive and very percussive piece.
Yes.
It starts like that. For me, it's not a big difference. It's just the same energy. The one is a plus and mm-hmm. the other is a minus.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, but sometimes when I write, for example, when I wrote my octet, which is a rather lyrical piece, it's a kind of sister piece to the lead.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a piece where the almost the piano is destroyed. I mean, I exaggerate this, of course, not destroyed, but the piano is hit
mm-hmm.
and inside the piano. So one of my most percussive pieces. So maybe my star sign is Gemini.
Yes.
Maybe that explains
yes.
that,
ah, okay.
that these, how it comes out of me, it can be very different. But I believe very much it's one energy or two parts of one energy.
Mm.
And this piece I wrote in 2001 for the Donau-Eschingen Festival. For
yes. Well, it sounded like it could be played there also.
It was my first piece in Donau-Eschingen. And mm. you know, for me, it was a very special experience because I had the privilege to work the first time together with this wonderful SWR Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, it was yes.
really unique orchestra
yes.
for modern music.
Yes.
I mean, everybody, Stockhausen, Boulez conducted
the yes, premier yes. their piece. And perhaps if some people, listeners, doesn't know, but Donau-Eschingen is one of the early festivals, I think, founded by Otto Klemperer and some other.
Hindemith
was there, yes. As a festival for only new music, and it has had a very important impact yeah. on the life of
so for
new
every
music.
Composer, it's something very special.
Yes, yes.
Asked to write for that, and I was young, so. But for me, it was less the festival; it was this orchestra.
Yes.
And it was a funny year for me, also in my biography, because it was in 2001. That was when I became professor for clarinet in Freiburg, which is only like
a short, yes, it's the same Baden-Württemberg.
Exactly,
right, yes,
so very close to Donau-Eschingen.
Mm.
And I started there in September, as you know.
Mm.
It's always it's in September, October, the festival.
Yes.
Donau-Eschingen. So it was the same time. I didn't even have an apartment at that time.
Mm.
I stayed at the Intercity Hotel at the train station in Freiburg in these days. And I remember these first rehearsals. It was in the Rosbaud studio in Baden-Baden.
Mm.
Boulez lived there
mm.
in Paris and Baden-Baden.
Yes.
And it was like Christmas for me. You know why? Because I wrote some, you know, pressing very hard on the thing.
Mm.
These kind of sounds. And the concertmaster stood up after the first run through. So I got scared. I thought, oh God, what is he telling me? And he said, Mr. Widmann, we can present you this sound in three different versions. or it was like Christmas. And we had 8 rehearsals for my piece. They played it so fantastically. So it was really unforgettable.
Mm.
And in the reviews, it was very funny. They said, well, the established composers, they wrote this and this, and they wrote their pieces. But the young Jörg Widmann, he was the only one who dared to write about our time, because you remember it was 9/11.
Yeah, yes.
Exactly then.
Yes.
So they thought implosion
yes.
refers
to the
Twin Towers
yes.
collapsing. And I can assure you, I finished my piece in end of August, and
yes,
I could
so
not have known
know.
About it. So they praised me for the wrong thing.
But you know, sometimes there is this words by Marshall McLuhan, a Canadian,
that's right.
who says
yes, yes.
early distant warning.
Yes,
so he
yes.
has this concept.
Yeah.
He had this concept of art that in art also, if you're good at understanding it, it also is a sign of something
that
coming.
Something is in the air.
In the air.
Of
yes.
The sense of anticipation.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. But that was implosion because
that was,
you mentioned.
Yes. Yes. Of course. Yes.
And then I took the train. I remember to Freiburg back. And this, my first semester started, but I was 27, you know. So I didn't think I can teach, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was Heinz Holliger, the wonderful oboist,
yes.
who also taught in Freiburg.
He taught in Freiburg.
And he called me when I was 26 and he said, so please audition for us, you know, for the professorship.
Mm.
And I told him on the phone.
I have no experience.
I'm young.
Mm.
And I have the impression I'm still learning.
Mm.
How could I teach other people?
Mm.
And he encouraged me so much because he said, You know, I started at the age of 26, 27 at the Freiburg Musikhochschule.
Oh, yes.
And I also couldn't teach, but I learned it. I was forced to learn it by learning by doing. And it was the same with me. You know? I even learned so much from my students. Why? Because they asked me questions. So I had to justify to myself again and in a new way and in a more urgent way. Why am I doing this on the clarinet? Why am I doing it? So I just did it, right? So that was very interesting for me to start teaching.
Yeah, that is often a good way, because I guess you, the clarinet, you started so early that it came quite natural to you. So you didn't really, you just did things, I suppose.
Exactly. Only in New York. I was just in New York.
Oh, yes.
At Juilliard School.
Yes.
Conducting the Juilliard Orchestra. It was like a coming home after so many years. I studied there in 1994, 95. And I remember it. I told my clarinet teacher, Charlie Neidick, who is one of the best clarinetists and teachers in the world, really. And he's still teaching there. And I told him, you know what you told me after lesson number one or lesson two? You know, you don't bring your instrument anymore the next two times. We have to restart thinking.
Your breathing.
Rethink your breathing.
Yes.
So I didn't think much about it, but then I really thought much about it.
Yes.
And the funny thing is the breathing became so important for me and the air. So what I, so my students, probably they were so annoyed of me. So I always said in every lesson to every student, more air. And one day I remember I came to the Freiburg Hochschule, to my room, to my teaching room, and the whole class was there. And the walls of my teaching room were covered by, you know, sheets of paper saying more air. So my students prepared it for me not having to say it 30 times a day.
Yes.
I could just point at the paper.
There you can see.
They were so sweet. And that was also a very sweet way of them of telling me that I maybe went 1 millimeter.
Yes, well. Yes. But breathing is very important in music.
It's for all
musicians. For all musicians. Yes. Yes. Very important.
And I believe in ensemble playing, in orchestra.
Yes.
I promise you, if people breathe together, it will be together. This is really my experience. You can tell them, this is too late. If you say, I had the real privilege a month ago, to first time to conduct the Berliner Philharmonic, which is really such a unique orchestra. And we had the most wonderful time from first minute on. It can be very different with them, as everybody reports. If they don't like it, they can be
okay.
But we liked each other from first moment. And even with them, because we're just making music together and we're trying to get the best result. Even with them, I don't even remember if it was in my piece or in Mendelssohn Symphony. I mentioned to the strings, I said, do me one favor. It sounds maybe ridiculous. Do me one favor. Let's breathe before. I think it was my piece, Barton piece. Back. I promise you, we didn't touch this place ever again because it was so together.
Okay.
And that was interesting.
Yes.
I'm convinced that the string players, pianists, should all breathe.
Yes. That proved the point, because a Bartok pitch doesn't come by itself together if you don't breathe.
So right.
Yes.
And believe me. So a Bartok pitch is you grab the string with two fingers and then you kind of back. It's on the fingerboard. It's a very physical thing to produce.
Yes.
And believe me, when I write a Bartok pitch, each one, it's a physical thing for me. I imagine the energy of anticipation, we talked about anticipation, which the musician has. And this energy, I hope you will hear in the music. I mean, it sounds too simple. I mean, there's not maybe this direct relation to it. But for me, a note is a human being. It has a certain start, it has a body, a certain tail or whatever, or a certain end. So it's a very, very physical thing for me, everything. Therefore, and that was another thing you mentioned in your introduction, that I do many things, or I play, I conduct, I compose, I teach. but if we would sit together, let's say, until the middle of the 19th century, it would have been the most natural thing.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And this unity of music and of music making, at least for me and myself, it has never stopped. It feels natural for me. There are some difficulties in time, of course.
Of course.
You know, writing requires a lot of time. Touring requires patience.
Yes.
Your body doesn't agree with it sometimes, right? But I'm so lucky I'm allowed to do it. Because, you know, now when I meet many people in Stockholm, I just come from Madrid, I played there. So I meet many wonderful people, which is wonderful. But then when I return back home, it's also equally wonderful to close my door and maybe do nothing or start my new orchestra.
Yes.
I need both aspects.
Yes. So in other words, you need to be by yourself in some solitude at times to compose. Yes,
absolutely, because the composing requires a lot of sitting.
It does. It does, and thinking also, yes, of course.
Absolutely.
Yes, but are you ever in a process of doubting yourself then when you compose, because you have so many commitments? To have, you know, orchestral pieces, they often want them in time, or and I don't know, perhaps you're in high demand also. People are asking you all the time to, can you write us a piece or me a piece in the question of a soloist?
You're right, but I could not write them if I would not doubt.
Okay, no, yeah.
So I tried to describe these doubts, you know, how in the creative process, without the doubts, I could not do it, you know.
I also heard some other rather strange piece in a way, also called Dubairische Tänze.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, is it a joke, this one, or is it... because I remember that Lachenmann, your German colleague, he wrote a kind of orchestral piece a few years ago, which...
Marsch Fatal. Which I love.
I loved it too, yes. But it's just unexpected when you see a new orchestral piece. What is this, you know?
And Helmut and myself, we like each other. And when we talk on the phone, for example, we talk a little bit about modern music too, about Nono and so on, but especially about Schubert.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And he has this incredible sense of humor in this piece, and he surprised so many people. Some people were really
upset.
Mad at him, upset.
Yes, yes.
Like he was betraying or.
Yes, you know, I know.
Traitor of modern music. No, he is not. He is one of the heroes of modern music. And he is now over 80 years old. Let him be free. And that's what he is interested in. And from a craftsmanship point of view, you cannot instrumentate better than Lachenmann does in general and in this Marsch Fatal. And you ask me if it's a joke, my piece, in a way, yes. And if we would ask Lachenmann...
Nothing wrong with that. I mean,
if Marsch Fatal is a joke, I could imagine he also says yes. But as always, if you make a joke, do it properly. The timing must be right.
Yes, right? Exactly. No, it's the most difficult thing to do.
It's the most difficult
thing. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And Marsch Fatal, I'm sure he wrote a long time on it.
Yes. But he is a slow composer, of course.
That's true.
He is like you, very much... a German composer, that he comes from the real German tradition. I mean, I've heard his lectures on, and I know him. I played his guitar duo, of course.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful music. But it's clearly that this is a composer with what you call each sound or each noise. That sometimes, because there are a lot of, is very well considered. You know, very well, and it has a history. It
Absolutely.
Goes back to something very different.
Why I wrote these Dubairische Tänze? So in English,
not really.
so Bayerisch in English is Bavarian.
Yes.
So Dubai is quite opera. Yeah. So it has Dubai and Bavarian in one word.
Yeah, yes.
And it was because we are doing this podcast for the Goethe Institute. It was a project of Siemens Cultural Program, the Ensemble Modern, and Goethe Institute. They send different composers to mega cities, to really big cities,
from
Kapstadt in South Africa, Chinese cities, and I chose Dubai. I was interested to hear Arab music on the streets, but
that was not there, though, to find.
It's not.
No, there. No, exactly. No.
There's nothing natural there,
no.
Except the wonderful nature. I mean, the desert. I went to the desert. The sea is basically dead now, you know, at least where they built these sand banks, these palmeras.
Yes.
Or how is it
called? Yeah. Is it the Red Sea there, perhaps? I don't know.
Ah, it's a good question.
Oh, never mind. I never mind.
But anyway, so it was so artificial and it's so clearly done for us Westerners.
Yes.
This city.
Yes.
So I had a hard time there.
Mm-hmm.
And next to it was so hot. So I was in my bed under the ventilation. And I, you know, for 2 weeks, I promise you, the only music which I had in my head was Bavarian folk music. I am from Munich, and sitting in Munich, it would never, ever come to my mind that I would write Bavarian music. Never, ever. So I had to be very far away, feel very alienated by this place. And maybe I was simply homesick, which I was. And one of these is called Strophen of Heimweh, of homesick.
Okay.
So
yes.
After 2 weeks, I decided, well, so that's what I will do. I was waiting for the Arab influences, which at least on the streets were not there. I had many interesting meetings with people there. One with a scientist, and he does the chronology, the chronic of the state.
Okay.
And he told us that in this culture, it's so strange to tell the ruling people that it's important to preserve something. For them, future is so important. So he has to always justify each year again why it's important to preserve culture. So sometimes to us Europeans, it's important to say, well, don't only preserve it. Go to the future, you know, but there it was the opening. So anyway, so then I decided to have a real clash of Arab music, but not of the music I heard there, of my Arab music, which was in my head.
Yes.
And of Bavarian music. So therefore, Dubai Recitanz.
It's fantastic.
And I take it very seriously, but of course it's a joke, but I take it very seriously.
No, it's obvious. I mean, the craftsmanship is impeccable and it works, you know, it's a piece of music. It works very well. And I think that's interesting in your case, but I think the orchestra actually liked it, or the players likes to play this. But is this important for you? I mean, because it seems to be so, at the same time you have these beautiful ideas, but it seems that you also are concerned about it, making it playable, which is not always the case. So, which means that you're perhaps or a practical musician in a way.
I think that's the reason, since I'm a musician myself.
Yeah, yes.
But on the other hand, you know, both aspects are important. I think really one has to go, you have to go for your vision. Right? So if I have an idea, I have to go for it. It's my task as an artist. But to me, it's important to know the limits of instruments. Not only the limits of instruments, to know the instruments and to know the limitations of it. And then on purpose, go one important millimeter beyond it. So that's how I would describe it.
Yes.
But I can only go beyond the limit if I know where the limit is. So that's how I would try to describe it.
That's interesting, yes.
So it would be too boring for me to know the limits and to stay within the limits and behave nicely.
Yes.
I would be bored by that.
Mm.
And it would be really stupid only to push boundaries if nobody can play it in the end. So what I do when I teach many times at the schools where I teach, so right now I'm teaching at the Baron Boim Said Academy.
Is that a school? I saw, yes.
It's at the Bulesa.
Yeah, okay.
The Baron Boim Fund.
Mm.
And we try, and in these days it's not easy at all.
You mean because of the...
people from the Middle East.
Yes.
Place in the center. Yes, yes. Part of Berlin.
Mm.
And you know, so it's Arabs, it's Israelis in one school. And of course, even before now this war broke out, even before, of course, in the canteen, in the building, in the main hall, they discuss loudly sometimes.
Mm.
But the wonderful thing about this academy is then at 2 o'clock rehearsal starts and they play Mozart together.
Mm.
I mean, it sounds naive in these days. And some politicians think, oh, we should cut all these projects.
Mm.
No, the opposite is the case.
Yes.
I think it's really, especially in these days, and I know it sounds hopeless and naive what I'm saying in these days, but I've been teaching at my school now for almost 7 years, and maybe we can't achieve much, and we for sure can't stop this horrible... What is horrible what is happening in the Middle East right now, but it's so important.
Yes.
We bring people together there.
Yes.
And what I try to do there is with my different, you know, aspects of what I do to bring people together, which means we have a workshop with an instrumental ensemble and composers. They write new pieces. So I sit there and I encourage the instrumentalists, tell the composers what's really impossible, tell them harshly, and tell them rather more than less.
Mm.
But if the composers say, well, but I want to go for it because of that, then I encourage the musicians as well. So suggest something to them.
Yes,
if that is
possible. Yes.
Then do something else,
yes.
And also to the composers. So I really try to bring
that's
them
important
to
because, of course, the idea of being impossible is also a part of course, the tension of music. I know this from because I played so many of these that write impossible music, and I always thought. but I always had the idea of that. Well, it may create a certain type of tension, a certain type of texture, which you cannot achieve in any other way by being, you know.
You are right. Totally
yeah, and I know that, to take an example from the orchestras, that Strauss wrote very difficult instrumental parts. But when he noticed that orchestras were able to play them, he was not all that satisfied because he was looking for an effect that perhaps different bowing of the strings would create. But when they played it perfectly, the effect was not what he was looking for. And this there is some truth in that, I guess. You know, even from someone as traditional as Strauss was, musically speaking, at least after his early operas.
Exactly. Mm. But that's what I find interesting in him. You know, because we always think, so at least, let's stay with Adorno, or in music philosophy, or music journalism even, what they disagree with Strauss is that he dared to do it this way, in this order, in this chronological order. If he would have written the sex and crime pieces, let's face it, right?
Mm.
Elektra and especially Salome, you know, which are shockers.
Yes, yes.
Real shockers.
Yes.
You know, if he would have started off with his Rosenkavalier and then developed to the modern pieces, then everybody would and then it would say in the music books, well, he prepared the modernity and he was one of the great. Well, and so we think he was conservative, which there are many conservative aspects for sure. But I'm always interested in questioning these things.
Mm-hmm.
Take the Wissenschaftsfuge, the fugue of science.
Yes.
In the Also sprach Zarathustra,
yes.
Probably one of the most famous pieces in the world since Hollywood used and misused it 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, boom, beam, ba-dum, you know, this famous.
Mm.
But there's this one part which is strictly 12-toned.
Yeah.
It's touched on in this piece, or even in the Rose and Cavalier, when the boy brings the rose, there are 11 celeste chords. You know, one more, it would be 12 tone. You know, Béla Bartók started composing because, and you are absolutely right, the early pieces. So, so because of Salome. And and he started disliking Strauss in the middle of Elektra, in the Orest Wiedererkennungsszene, when they discover each other, they recognize each other again. Then he calls it in German Kapellmeistermusik.
Yes.
And he says, well, it's just, I mean, what we discussed before, he just does what is what he knows is possible, right? I'm not sure if that's right. But what's for sure right is that Salome and the beginning, and I would say the whole of Elektra, are still one of the most modern pieces.
Yes.
For sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, at the premiere, Alban Berg was at the premiere of Salome, or at the Austrian premiere in Graz. So I always disliked Strauss when I was younger. And I agreed with Alban Berg, who said, either you are Mahlerian or Straussian.
Okay.
And I was all my life, I loved Mahler so much. And I must tell you, the older I get, the more I admire Strauss, and it touches me deeply. I even recorded, there's a wonderful late piece for clarinet, bassoon, strings, and harp, and which he calls a finger exercise for myself,
not to
get too far away from composing. I mean, every body of us would be quite pleased and lucky if that's the result of a finger exercise. A really wonderful piece. So the older I get, I must say.
But also Strauss, there is, because you have touched upon Schubert, there are aspects of him that belongs also to this tradition, because it's at the end, Strauss is also some kind of sadness into it.
Absolutely.
Some enormous melancholy, even more than in Mahler, I would say, who has that, he has that too, but...
well, in Mahler, it's more masochistic.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, in Mahler 6, it's hard to, if the third stroke of bang or not, it breaks your heart. But Strauss has this surface, this brilliant surface. I mean, Mahler too. But in Strauss, Don Juan, and so on. But there are moments, and or take at the end of his life, the Metamorphosen.
Of course.
I mean, it's a heartbreaking piece. And
So are the songs, of course, the four.
The four last songs.
Yes, amazing.
I mean, even the positive moments, you know, when the birds start flying. It's beautiful, but it's the last time, right?
Perhaps, yes, we're gone. It's so interesting. I would have liked to go on for many hours more. And because I went through so much music and I have so many other questions to put forward. But
one day
we will continue. So thank you very much for this talk, Jörg.
It was
great to have you. And good luck for the festival. I'm sure it will be great. And yes, I will be at a few of the concerts for sure.
Look forward.
So I will see you again.
Since I was not many times in Sweden.
No, I know.
And it was the country of my dreams as a child. I wished from my parents for Christmas, when I wished things. I wished piano reductions of Don Giovanni, of
yes,
and books of Scandinavia and of Sweden.
Okay.
And I said, I want to go there. My father is not alive anymore, unfortunately. Ah. But if he would know that there's so much of my music in Stockholm now, I think
he would be awesome. Very happy. And also there is a relationship in history with Sweden and Germany.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, it is a bit subdued today, but the connections are very strong through culture. And you know, the dream of the famous fairy tale writers, the Brother Grimm.
Yes.
Well, their dream was to move to Sweden.
Yes. At least this we have in common.
Yes, fairy tale guys.
I love fairy tales too.
Yes. So great. So all the best. Speak soon, I hope. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Du har lyssnat på Tysklandspodden, en podcast producerad av Goethe-Institut Schweden.